With our two special guests tonight, David Paris and Bruce Gernon, as we talk about the Bermuda Triangle, more of their incredible journey on Coast to Coast AM. Professor Paris, I was thinking of having my staff put together a Coast to Coast cruise through the Bermuda Triangle. I'm not sure that's a good idea. What about the ships that disappear in that region?
See, George?
Yeah.
Can we back up for just a minute? Because Professor Paris just explained something in that last segment that I don't think you may have picked up on or the listening audience. He has come up with a revolutionary new theory that he created after meeting with me on two occasions. But first, I'd like to tell you something, though, about David. I've worked with some famous scientists. Dr. Manson Valentine was the first one that discovered me, and then he wrote about me in his book with Charles Berlitz, Without a Trace. And
right.
I spent time working with him, and then the famous scientist, Dr. Arthur C. Clarke, contacted me, and he was the first to put me on television, on his television show.
So you've had some heavy hitters in your life, Bruce.
Yes, but no one like David. This man is incredible on what he has discovered, and the data that he has collected is far beyond any scientist, and I've worked with many, not just those two. And I believe that he is definitely onto something here that's going to be known worldwide pretty soon.
Well, that's quite a compliment there, David.
Well, yeah, it is. Thank you, Bruce.
Okay.
Almost don't have sufficient flow of speech here.
Well, back to that new theory that you just came up with. See, now, I was 100 miles away from Miami when I entered this tunnel. And the tunnel appeared to be about 10 miles long. And it should have taken me like 3 minutes to go through this tunnel.
Did it look like a tunnel, or was this more of an electronic type, magnetic type thing where you can't see it?
No, you can see it. I've got lots of photographs of them, and I've seen and watched many of them form over the Everglades. They usually last about 3 minutes once they connect, and then they collapse. But this one was like the biggest one I've ever seen, though. And when I reached the end of it, after only 20 seconds, I felt this strange sensation that I've never experienced before. It was sort of a combination of zero gravity and hydroplaning forward.
Huh.
And it lasted about 10 seconds. And then at the same time, the blue sky that I had just entered instantly disappeared and turned into this gray electronic fog. And so then the feeling went away after 10 seconds. And I'm thinking I'm 90 miles away from Miami, because I was 100 when I entered the tunnel. And then I noticed all the electronic instruments are malfunctioning. But I was able to contact Miami radio. And that's the time when they couldn't find me on radar.
Which is strange all by itself.
Yeah, so another 3 minutes passed. And then all of a sudden, these strange lines formed, and in this electronic fog, it like electronically dissipated, which only took about 10 seconds. And now here I am directly over Miami Beach. And so I thought I traveled this 100 miles in 3 minutes and 20 seconds, which is absolutely incredible. But Professor Paris has come up with a new theory that during that weightless feeling of 10 seconds, I was transported 80 miles, and I was 10 miles offshore of Miami Beach when I contacted them on the radio. And when he first told me this, I said, no.
No way.
No way. But then after a couple of days, it started sinking in, and I started analyzing it more and more. And I said to myself, this could, it could be possible. He might be right, because it would have taken me 3 minutes to fly those 10 miles offshore of Miami to get over Miami Beach. And so I believe he's probably right. It was the space warp was way faster than I had even realized.
Is this like a wormhole, David, like that movie Contact, which was in space?
No, and unfortunately, Carl Sagan developed that for his, you know, originally for his book, and in the right. movie they carried that with it. The predictions on that is an inordinate amount of energy to try to even sustain or create and open a wormhole. In a local space warp, you're looking at a bubble that encapsulates the craft. That's what makes it even more plausible, not only from the theoretical, but from the empirical, which I believe is exactly what happened to Bruce in his case. So these little bubbles that would form, in essence, there's no relativistic mass increase or time dilation effects when you're in this local flat space or the local space warp.
Cal, I want to get into your electronic fog in your theory, but I am puzzled about the ships, because they seem to disappear too. Yet we're talking about something that seems to be a cloud. Or, as Bruce was saying earlier, the cloud is sometimes right on the top of the ocean.
Right.
Are these ships going through this, and are they being affected the same way?
Well, you can have this ionized field on to the surface of the water as well as up in the air as well. These ionized particles have an attraction. And when you fly in an airplane through these fields, the engine exhaust itself has carbon in it. And what I've discovered in the lab using a simple microwave oven, but don't do this at home, is put a little bit of carbon into the bottom of the microwave. And I'm sure everybody's going to be running to do this right now.
Yeah, I'll put lead pencils, right?
Yeah. And you put a little bit of carbon in there, and all this does is show the similarity of what happens is taking the energy and coalescing it to the carbon. And in this particular case, you know, you set the microwave on high for 25 seconds, and you can have these plasmoids generating off into your microwave. Not good for the magnetron inside, but the point being is that the exhaust from the aircraft, as this thing goes through these ionized air, it has an attraction to the carbon and coalesces to it, and it falls right up the exhaust and encapsulates the aircraft. And in the airplane, on the other hand, it also looks like an antenna. The wings and the tail section looks just like an omnidirectional antenna, a little elongated here and there. But in essence, it's made of metal, it's conductive, and this energy, once it encapsulates the aircraft, will begin to take offline the electronic equipment. In Bruce's case, he had the antenna just right behind the cockpit, which there's a null area up above and below here on this encapsulation, and his radio was buried into the console of the aircraft, and the engine still was still turning, and he didn't have any disruptions in the engine because there's shielding around the magnetos there, as well as you have the cowling. And I've also gone into the FAA records of their evaluation of what they refer to as high-intensity radiative fields. And at 4,000 electron electric potential volts, at about 700 megahertz, which is in the areas of higher into the clouds, like we're talking about 10,000 feet now, they've found that if you have, say, fly-by-wire mechanisms, they'll go offline. So they can actually breach the shielding on these high exposures. And this is also can be done with radar or, you know, radiative fields from cell towers, you fly too close, these types of things. But here you're in a thunderstorm, and all of his mechanisms were cable. All the controls were manual, and the throttle was manual. So he had, in essence, the equipment that he lost, he could still fly the aircraft.
Right, so and that was a big difference, too.
And that's in 1970 as well. So the more modern-day aircraft are more electronically geared up for everything. So if another aircraft went through this same scenario, it may not have come out in as good a shape as what as Bruce had done.
Is it possible that that French Airbus that basically disintegrated over the Pacific many months ago? You remember that case?
Well, it was over the Atlantic, but yes, I remember it. And
It's near South America.
Yeah, yeah. And what was really fascinating, it was disturbing as far as the aircraft going down, loss of life.
Sure.
But the last message that I had seen on the reports, at least, was that all electrical systems were offline. And determination several weeks later was that the aircraft actually was intact before it crashed, nose down into the water. They found the tail section and other items like that, but they didn't find the black boxes. And I guess what concerns me, if you actually get into the FAA documentation for single and fixed-wing aircraft, they have these tables set up of when instruments could go offline based on the exposure here, okay? You go through a thunderstorm like they did, and that was a huge line. There weren't any spaces between the clouds. And I believe is what they did was they flew right through these things. And, you know, just like I said, some of the calculations that I've made, these things are tremendous.
Yes, they couldn't fly around it. It was too large of a storm, so they must have gone ahead
and they penetrated
into it. And it was hard to believe that one of the latest modern airplanes would have, like, electrical failure like that. But when you explained about all the power that's in a storm, then it's easier to understand.
Right, and once you lose the electronics in planes like that, Bruce, you're in trouble.
Well, and the other something even more important is when you lose the fly-by-wire mechanism and it gets overridden by an external field, now you got serious problems because you can't manipulate your throttle, you can't manipulate the surfaces of the airfoils. You're in big trouble. And
we started the program by talking about Flight 19, those five Avengers that disappeared in 1945. Have you looked at that, David, case?
Yeah, I have, and it looks like there's contributory factors to the loss of the flight in the fact that at that time there was enough sunspot activity and they did have a fairly good solar wind going on that day, and the weather conditions, ironically, was when we did our flight with the History Channel, we went behind a cold front as it went through north to south of Florida. And this is very much like what happened on Flight 19, which was kind of eerie, to say the least. And we didn't get off the ground until late afternoon, which was about the time of Flight 19 as well. And too many things started to fall into place that were more like Flight 19 than I cared to mention. But as the flight progressed, we encountered the beginnings of the towering cumulus and the beginnings of thunderstorms, like what they would have seen late in the afternoon. But coupled with the solar winds, compass spinning, compass direction, the entry of the flux transfer up from the from space down into the atmosphere can be quite substantial. And a compass is a very sensitive instrument to start with.
Of course. Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of people that will claim that compasses can only deviate just a few degrees. Well, I'm sorry, but I've taken a lot of reports from pilots and have heard and have read the testimony personally, and they claim, and as Bruce has claimed, that his compass had a slow spin to it. Well, you know, people are fairly good observers, in my opinion, and they may not understand what's happening, but they certainly have eyes, and they can tell you what has happened. And in the case for Bruce and other pilots that I've talked to, they claim that these compasses spin.
Yes, it was spinning very slowly counterclockwise for me when I was inside this electronic fog. And I've talked to several pilots that have experienced spin. It is in clear weather, though, for them.
Yeah, and I've got a testimony of a pilot that in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, was about 200 miles off of Sarasota Springs, and in the Gulf on an old air route. I think he called it A-187. And 2 years difference between the first encounter, he had the same thing happen to him in another airplane. He was flying in the Navy, the first encounter, in a training aircraft, and the compass diverted. And he didn't really notice, and he was just, you know, kept flying the compass, and he ended up going towards Cuba until somebody radioed him and said, you need
going
to turn back
way.
This way. Yes. Or else you may encounter something you don't want to see.
And sometimes the compass can spin quite rapidly. I've heard from several pilots, too. And just recently, there was a pilot flying in the Bahamas near Abaco, and his compass did a 30-degree dip. Have you ever heard of that one, David? That's the first one I've heard of that.
No, no.
Usually that sounds huge, Bruce,
it dipped
doesn't it?
Down. And it upset him quite a bit.
Well, and again, this is if I found out the date and the time of when this occurred, and if you go back and relate these things to the incoming solar winds up into the magnetosphere, the magnetosphere breaks open about approximately every 8 minutes. And as this plasma puddles in, the magnetosphere is strong enough that it will actually shunt the solar winds themselves, a majority of them. But as these things break open, then it allows that energy to enter in, and you get all kinds of protons, electrons, stuff just, you know, barreling through. And it's very interesting to see at that point then, where does this stuff go? And if you're during this time period of between November and February, Earth closest to the sun at that point, 91 million miles, and there seems to be this current, this eddy effect that goes up from the South Pole up into the equator regions of the north of there. And it seems like that area within the Bermuda area seems to be more affected. This also, like I said, occurs into the Gulf, into the Pacific, but this particular area, we seem to have a lot of encounters there. And is it due to magma being closer to the surface up near the Bermuda itself? Is that an integral part of this? Well, I can't tell you exactly that's a cause and effect, but you're going to find in any of these investigations, there's no one single thing that is the cause and effect of the occurrence. It's usually a combination of things, and that you got to have the right weather scenario, you've got to have the right instability in the air, you got to have the right amount of energy in the solar winds, all these things coupled together. And is there a guarantee that you can have this happen every single time? No. But if the conditions are right, the probability is very high that this can occur. That's one of the things that Bruce and I would like to try to do is to reproduce his particular scenario. Now, he and I are not going to fly.
No, I don't blame you. Too bad you can't do it in a laboratory. Or can
well,
you?
What
but
we were looking
a flying
what we were,
laboratory.
But what we were looking at trying to do as well as doing a little micro experiment that I'm working on right now was to see if we could find some an entity, you know, like I'll just throw it out like NASA or something that has unmanned vehicles that we could load up with some instruments. And during these particular conditions, try to find a similar scenario so we could reproduce this thing again. Because, you know, look, the listening audience out there, you know, they're hearing this and they're going, yeah, right, okay, you know. But, you know, we've taken this down as much as we can to provide the data and to look at the whole scenario. And now it's time for other scientists that are interested in something like this to get together. And instead of letting this go for like 300 years, like in the case of rogue waves, which, you know, we're going to talk about that with the ships at sea, going missing, one of the things, mechanisms there, very physical, is to take the ship out because you got a 100-foot wave coming at you.
David, we're going to take this break. You too as well, Bruce. When we come back, let's talk about your theories and also how you predict these. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, indeed. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with David Ferris and Bruce Gernon. But there's more about their predictions and theories on the Bermuda Triangle when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. David, I guess for us to understand the predictions, we need to talk about the theories, but they could be one and the same. Tell me about the theory behind this.
Well, in making comparisons, you've heard Bruce describe his experience as he went through the tunnel, coming out of the tunnel, and how he felt that there was a slight forward acceleration, this hydroplaning and his sense of weightlessness. Mm-hmm. What's interesting here is that all of his explanations, as he went through his encounter, very interestingly enough, and he didn't know about Alcubierre at all, and what he had written up on his particular aspects of what would happen to a craft that would get into a local space warp. And on board the craft, there is no relativistic mass increase or time dilation, and that the clock runs at the same speed of the external observer. This is very interesting because exactly what happened to him, and that the feeling of weightlessness is that the crew or the people on board the ship, when it's accelerating, it's always on a free fall. So in other words, the ship's using the warp to accelerate or deaccelerate is always in free fall, and the crew would experience no additional G-forces, and enormous tidal forces, and this is his prediction, would be at the edge of the bubble, but within the content of the flat space volume, they wouldn't feel anything, and they would feel very much like in a weightless-like feeling. So what we have put together here is based on Bruce's event and his observations, is that when he enters that tunnel, and this is very interesting because Alcubierre talks about a linear progression, okay, and he developed this for space travel, and you go in a straight line. But what we found out here, if this is indeed a sample of a warp environment, is that he entered at 10,000 feet, he exited at 10,000 feet over Miami Beach, which means that it's the Earth's mass influences a local space warp bubble. So that means that if you had a series of aircraft and you went at 10,000, 15, and 20,000 feet, you could park them in those at that altitude, and they would come back out at the same altitude, so you could do spacing of travel. Now, the whole thing is, how do you induce all this? And I've been thinking about this as far as do you fly through this big hoop in the sky that dipoles, and you fly the airplane through there, and all of a sudden, poof, you know, you go from New York and you're in London, you know, within a few seconds. And that was one of the other things. A friend of mine, we've discussed this a lot, and you know, shoot ideas back and forth. But one of the comments that he had is, what if that hole that he went through wasn't pointed at Miami? What if it was pointed at Africa? Would they have found an A-36 Bonanza in the middle of the desert? And he had gotten there in just a few seconds. He would have had a lot of explaining to do as why he didn't have his passport. Just they have to go to Africa or whatever. But
or what if it was aiming up toward the heavens?
Or if it was going to the North Pole, there would have been a real mystery without the pilot telling you what happened in this particular encounter. No one would have ever figured it out. I don't think that would have really went into the paranormal at that point. But we were fortunate that he survived. We were fortunate that he was able to make this extremely detailed account of his sensories, of what he felt, what he saw. And based on everything, it mates against the Alcubierre space warp. Now, the energy... the amount of energy that it entails on generating this thing, there's a huge difference between what, like I said, the theoreticians say, to what actually, I believe, happened to Bruce. And the only way to verify this is to try to replicate this in some manner, either in the lab or out into the environment, once again, is to forecast, which, like I said, I put together the forecast parameters for this. And I think Bruce can testify to this. This is kind of funny. We're doing our second shoot with the National Geographic. and Bruce comes out. We're all gathering together around the hangar there, and he looks up. It's a blue sky. There's no clouds anywhere. And Steve, chase plane pilot, he goes out. I've been here for 40 years, and it's a blue sky. There's no thunderstorms down in Key West. And guess what? 3 days before, I had seen that there was going to be the high and low pressure systems coming up over Florida, and there was going to be a coal area here, this area of transition. And what I was forecasting for is that you were going to get storms kicked off in Key West. And Bruce, you want to tell us what we found?
Yeah, that was quite a prediction, because I agreed with my pilot friend that it was going to be a clear day. And
yeah,
we were kind of wasting our time going around looking for thunderstorms. And, I'm familiar with the local weather, and here comes this guy from Omaha, and he says it's going to be big thunderstorms forming down here. I don't know where you're coming from, but we're going to go flying anyway and see what's out there. And but he was looking at all these weather sources that he has to predict this. And so, sure as heck,
there it was.
They captured it on TV too. I have a Garmin 1000 that has NexRed radar on it, and it was clear when we took off. And then these green spots start showing up, and then they started turning yellow, and then we could start to see them right in front of us. And then all electricity had a total electrical failure on the airplane.
Oh, geez. It's almost on cue.
Now, the other thing was that, but the other thing that didn't cooperate with us that day was that the solar winds were real low. They were well below 300 kilometers per second. And usually if you're going to get within this combination, in this context of the isolated storms and with the generation electronic fog, you got to have the solar winds. And in his particular case, in Bruce's first flight, they were well over 732, I believe, kilometers per second. Mm. So you've got to have a pretty healthy energy push from space to generate this unique situation.
David, are you still refining this theory?
Oh, I think about this all the time. I mean, I teach a lot of classes and stuff, but every time I, do a lecture, and which is almost every day for hours and hours, every time you go over the material again, there's something always, I got another idea about this, and we got to look at that.
And he has a new website that's pretty amazing already, but it's still under construction.
Paris Weather Research.
Check that out, too.
Yeah, I think that's listed on the Coast to Coast website as well.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that of the server blowing up, but I guess you get what you get,
You get what you get. Well, you know what, Dave? I got to tell you, if this ends up being a form of a new propulsion system in terms of travel, you're up for a Nobel Prize of Science. You're going to get that.
Yeah, well, I think so.
You know what I look at this as being an opportunity for? If this all pans out, everything works the way it's supposed to work, and we can validate this thing with the scientific community, we're going to become a spacefaring nation, a spacefaring world. And if everybody's worried about the economy and that, when you go to space, this is like an endless economy. When you build spacecraft and you have to have people to support those craft, you go colonize the moon, you go mine the asteroid zone between Mars and Jupiter, bring back precious materials that we lack here onto the Earth. We need a lot more platinum than we really have available here onto the Earth to be an industrialized society.
When do you think realistically we might be able to recreate this on a larger scale, not a smaller one?
At will. I've been looking at this one of these fractal antennas that you could stick on the outside of an aircraft to generate the field necessary. And of course, I believe is that we need to investigate and try to recreate his scenario using nature, because nature has given us a huge clue here. I believe that it's been done in the past, but he's a surviving pilot that can testify to what really went on. So if we can reproduce his scenario, again, using the forecast, having an unmanned aircraft fly through this thing, we might be able to get the data necessary to validate all of the various pieces and parts of this. And I think it's very possible, but personally, I don't have the money to do that. So if an organization such
as... You need grant money for something like this,
well,
don't you?
Well, you would think that an organization such as NASA that needs propulsion, needs to be able to venture into space, that unless they're already working on this, and again, a lot of theoreticians, physicists around the world have been working on this, on the warp drive, the Alcubierre, and, you know, he suffered a tremendous amount of ridicule, Alcubierre, and on what he had come up with. But other scientists since then have come up with papers such as more reasonable energy levels for the Alcubierre effect. And, you know, what we're looking at is, so for so many years, Bruce has been belittled and discounted for his experience. And no one's ever really taken the time to look at what really happened to him. And now that we're trying to tell everybody is that, hey, this is a for real thing. As best as we can put all their data together, it appears that this is exactly what happened. And, by the way, that the Earth mass affects the local space warp, which means it goes to the curvature of the Earth. And we also found out that in the as this local space warp occurs, is that it doesn't have these dramatic effects of tidal forces onto the exterior of the space warp. There weren't any big, huge waves generated onto the surface of the ocean. There wasn't any huge atmospheric disturbance as a result of doing this. So it's, I think, very encouraging that it could be a very manageable terrestrial radar mechanism of travel. And then if you go into space, huh, I mean, how would you like to go to Mars in about a couple of hours? And part of the problem with this, too, is Alcubierre had, was he didn't know how to stop the field once he began to generate it when he was in space. And that was a big concern to him. Now, in the case of the local space warp bubble and the electronic fog that we've been talking about, interestingly enough, if it's generated out over the ocean and you head towards land, it dissipates. This is very good.
It's just good the opposite, too, David.
And the opposite happens if it occurs on land, which it can, and it has, like over the Everglades, this seems to be a prime spot for this. And if you go out over the ocean, it dissipates. So, again, we seem to have a kind of a built-in natural mechanism here. Go to land, dissipates, go out to the ocean, will dissipate as well. So we have, it looks like, some mechanisms here to control it if we can reproduce it. So I'm very excited about it. The thing is, right at this juncture, is that we need to try to figure out and gain access to some other research, either funds or aircraft, or, you know, somebody that wants to partner up with us and to try to do this. I think we could break this thing open and say one way or the other.
Would that be dramatic?
It would be. I mean, and again, I relate this back to kind of like the rogue waves, in a sense that for hundreds of years, mariners have been discredited and discounted of the fact that they observed that there were these huge waves out into the ocean. And it's taken ships. It can come at night, can come at any time of the day. And there's all different reasons for why rogue waves can appear and then disappear as soon as they appear. Underwater obstruction, seamounts, currents that oppose each other, that a little bit of a different angle, that opposition and the force of the water can actually force a wave up to the top. Wind action, constructive interference of waves as they come across due to wind action, for example, and every 10,000, 100,000 waves that come by, they'll join up with another and then eventually another. And this can form wave heights well up to 100 feet, and you have that dramatic picture from that supertanker, where the wave is crashing over the bow, which is 60 feet off the ground, and then you got the cranes that are about another 60 feet or so above the deck, and here it is coming up about a little over halfway of the crane, which puts it around 90 to 100 feet, and they survive because the bow happened to be, you know, and it's a big ship, but if they were on the side and they took this wave, all bets are off. That would have probably capsized immediately and started to fill with water and go down like a toy ship in a bathtub, you know?
Any tie-in here between your theories and what the Mayans knew 2012?
Oh, well, you really want to hear what I have to say about that?
I sure do.
Okay. Well, if you looked at the Mayan society, and they had the and I always point to the sacred the water hole that they had, which they drank from, right?
Yeah, they did.
Okay. This is the place where they did human sacrifice and then threw the bodies into the water, okay? Dead bodies don't make for good drinking water, do they?
No.
And
no,
you can cholera and all kinds of other diseases.
That's right.
So I always look at it this way. And, 5,000 years before was the stick people. And then 5,000 years before them was the mud people. And these are people that threw dead bodies. And if they were supposed to be so smart about the future of 2012 here, do you really think I'm going to believe what they got to say about the end of days here? I find it, I know people out there are going to be outraged, 2012, but it has to happen. Look, the Earth has been here for 4.4 billion years, 4.7 billion years, and I lay a bet with a very good friend of mine, but is very adamant about 2012. I put out, I'm not a betting man, okay? I put $100 down and say, I can guarantee you after the 21st of December 2012, we're still going to be here.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah, I'd go along with that, too.
Yeah. Might have some kind of solar event, I think, but I think you're right. We're going to be here.
And that's I don't want to mess up anybody's fun with this, but, I'm afraid too many people are getting, they're starting to froth up, all this hype. And that's exactly what it is. It's, if you had some real data to go with this, and this is a science guy, I guess.
All right, but, David, how often do you think these cloud formations, because I'm going to talk about your predictions again, but how often do you think they form out there in the Bermuda Triangle area?
Well, this is something that doesn't occur every day. And I've talked to a lot of pilots and have had full careers in flying through the triangle. I've never seen anything ever happen. Yeah, you're right. And you will have experiences like that. But when the conditions are just correct, now to the degree that they happen, when everything's in place, all I can say easily is that you're going to see this a dozen or more times a year, at least, if not more. But again, we don't have that many living pilots that have gone through this stuff and can tell the story either.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And again, I always want to stress, I cannot account for all of these missing aircraft for that particular reason. But I believe it is one of the reasons that is related into this area.
And David, I believe it can form in a weaker intensity, because I've seen these tunnels form a lot over the edge of the Everglades, in between the Florida Bay and the Everglades, where
yes.
We went flying that day.
And, yes, I
some of them aren't that big, compared to the one I threw.
Right. Everything has a variability as far as intensity. And I mean, some of the pilots that I've talked to in the Gulf situation, they had a veil effect around their aircraft. It was very light, but yeah. they the horizon disappeared for them. And the compass still spun and all this. And again, we've had reports of pilots in the clear blue sky with compasses spinning as well, slowly, rapidly. There's a different degrees as we go through there. Color. I made a chart of the various aircraft and colors that were reported. Martin Kaden, I think you're familiar with him.
Yes.
Famous aviation writer, movie producer, and great enthusiasm for aviation. Well, he was flying a PBY Catalina. And they encountered a yellow fog, Lindbergh, a green fog, and actually his personal accounts down near Cuba, flying near the Florida Keys. Bruce has had several encounters. Some of his friends have had encounters.
Hey, David, we're going to take this quick break. Then we'll come right back with you. And we'll open up the phone lines as well.